is director of the Institute for Church History and Missions at the University of Copenhagen. He is also the propositus, that is to say, the advisor or director, the leader of the Collegium Domus Regi. It's an interdisciplinary study house at Copenhagen. It occupies a very picturesque quadrangle of buildings with rooms for students and also living quarters for the director. At the Regensen, as it is commonly called, endowed in 1623 by the Danish King Christian IV, Professor Grana there has a chance to meet with students not only in theology but in other disciplines as well. His books disprove the myth some have that everything that is worth reading is translated into English. His work on Abelard is available. His work on the Augsburg Confession, a kind of guide through its main points and highlights, is in the process of being translated, but for the rest, you're going to have to either know German or learn Danish. His book, The Contra Gabrielum, outlines Luther's confrontation with the nominalist Gabriel Biel, and Luther's move away from that sort of theological approach. And then there is also his Modus Loquendi Theologicus, discussing Luther's thoughts in 1515 to 1518, again, as he seeks to renew theology, to come at it from different angles. And so he knows very well the early Luther and Luther's theological development, so that he is indeed a qualified man to speak to us this morning on the topic of Luther and his intersection with scholasticism. Please welcome Professor Dr. Leif Grana.
Although time is short, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to apologize for my dashing off after this lecture. It's not my habit to do things like that, and I didn't want to do it, but the plans for my travel have been changed in different ways, and I got a little confused and thought that everything I had to do here would be yesterday, and my ticket was then irrevocable. I couldn't change it again. So I really beg you to apologize. I don't think of myself as somebody so important that I'm allowed just to dash off this if you didn't exist after the lecture. I'm really sorry about that. But well, better go into the material. Luther's attitude towards scholasticism is of, as far as I can see, of great importance to his whole theology and his whole life. There are several reasons for this assertion. First, it is an established fact that Luther's own point of departure was in scholastic philosophy and theology. And second, when he first sought to draw public attention to his academic activities, he came forward as an enemy of scholasticism, not only as a method and form of theology, but also as a basis of the university curriculum. Third, when he became famous and indeed notorious through the 95 theses on indulgences, the ensuing contest was a continuation of the anti-scholastic campaign which he had begun before the 95 theses. And last, after the rupture with Rome, Luther never stopped commenting on scholastic issues, partly because he rightly identified Roman theology at that time with scholastic theology, partly because he never ceased to employ scholastic terms for his own purposes. These four arguments both establish the significance of this topic in Luther's own context and indicate some of the main problems connected with the topic. They thus provide the framework for the following discussion of Luther and scholasticism. Our knowledge of the University of Erfurt and of the monastery in the same town, leaves no doubt about the kind of education that Luther received there. He was trained in the Via Moderna, probably of an alchemist type, at both university and monastery. We have every reason to believe that the teaching in the Erfurt monastery was alchemist, perhaps in the spirit of Gabriel Biel of Tübingen, but we know very little in detail about the content of this teaching. Even if we did possess more information, we would still be far from knowing precisely to what extent this learning, this teaching, was decisive for Luther's development. Only in the minds of scholars are students regarded as true duplicates of their teachers. Genuine students are not such copies, unless they are unduly dependent on their professors, due to tyranny on the part of the professor or to lack of personality on the part of the student. And therefore, to know if we knew about the teaching in Erfurt, that would not at all learn us what had been decisive for Luther. The only statement we can make with some certainty before going into Luther's own words is that he learned to think in a scholastic way according to the Via Moderna and to master the subject of theology according to late medieval standards. In order to avoid the pure speculation which will inevitably result if we regard Luther as a product of different spheres of influence summarized under labels like nominalism, mysticism, humanism, or whatever, we have only one obvious way to go. We must read the sources, the writings of Luther, the lectures, the sermons, and the letters. From the earliest testimony of Luther's theology which we possess, the marginal notes of 1509 to 1510 on the medieval handbook of Christian theology by Peter Lombard, there can be no doubt whatsoever that we are encountering a scholastic theologian. His way of arguing, his concepts, his references, in short, everything which has to do with method is scholastic through and through. He really reveals himself here as an adherent of the Via Moderna, and he uses terms and arguments which are typical of the alchemist school. But nevertheless, he is not at all easy to pin down. For instance, he is obviously in these notes thinking about the freedom of the human will according along lines which are characteristic of the schools of John Scotus and William of Ockham. But his way of using familiar concepts is, if not original, then at least not derived from any other written sources. So we can see he is clearly a scholastic theologian, but nevertheless of a certain independence. By becoming an expositor of the Bible through joining the theological faculty at Wittenberg in 1512, Luther became familiar with another theological tradition, exegesis. The significance of this change of scene compared with the notes on Peter Lombard cannot be overestimated. Whereas the practice of theological teaching based on the four books of the sentences made it natural to build almost exclusively on the scholastic commentaries, the exegetical tradition offered Luther immediate access to biblical exposition behind and beyond scholasticism. Behind meaning the church fathers, beyond meaning the use of humanist biblical studies. There's reason to assume that not only the non-scholastic sources but also the biblical text itself, led Luther to ways of thinking which were different from those of the scholastic mind. Nevertheless, no reader of the first lecture on the Psalms can overlook the instances in which Luther's scholastic training comes to the fore. These passages are not frequent, but they are very clear and testify to Luther's original adherence to scholasticism of an Occamist type. If we consider the sermons from the same period, it is peculiar to see that the scholastic mode of thinking seemed to be more persistent here. Whatever kept him, I have some proposals, but I think I'll keep them out here. Whatever kept him from a breakthrough in preaching similar to that in lecturing, the lectures and the study behind them did influence the sermons in content, if not yet in form. In these years, Luther was on his way toward a theology which was to be incompatible with scholasticism in every aspect. We can therefore, I think, offer the following conclusions to the first part of this discussion. The early literary material, including the lecture on the Psalms, demonstrates that scholastic training was Luther's point of departure as theologian. The lecture on the Psalms shows that he is moving away from a scholastic way of thinking. There's nothing in this early material to suggest that any specific literary source, apart from the exegetical literature and the Bible itself, was instrumental in this transition. The picture appears the same with regard to the content of Luther's theology, although we must also allow for non-literary sources and influences, such as the mode of life in the monastery, or talks with fellow friars, especially Staupitz. When references to systematic theology occur in the lecture on the Psalms, they are always of an Occamist type. We have therefore no reason to assume any development in Luther within the scholastic framework. The development we can observe is, so to speak, outside the scholastic framework. In the lectures on Romans 15:15 to 16, the picture changes considerably. Scholastic theology plays a much greater part than in the lecture on the Psalms, but on quite a different level. If the lecture on the Psalms testifies to a certain alienation from scholasticism on Luther's part, the lectures on Romans demonstrate his open hostility. In his struggle to understand the Pauline text, concentrated around concepts like sin, justification, faith, grace, love, and so forth, Luther rediscovered the scholastic doctrines on these subjects, but in such a way that he had to turn against them. His reading of some of the anti-Pelagian writings of Augustine, used as tools in his interpretation of Paul, gave him the necessary support to initiate a fight against scholastic theology, in which he denounced it as both metaphysical and moralistic. When Luther established to his own satisfaction that the traditional philosophical theology conflicted with Paul and was consequently an obstacle to understanding the gospel, he could not simply confine this realization to his students in the lecture hall. He had to do more. He had to pronounce publicly his convictions. Only one means was immediately available to him. He could use the academic disputation as a way to take action in the appropriate setting, the university. It is typical of him not to take this step until he himself was quite sure, not of everything, but at least of the unfitness of scholastic theology as an interpretation of the Bible. He used the promotion of one of his students in September 1516 in the disputation about the human will outside grace. This disputation was not an isolated event. From now on, one of Luther's main goals was to fight scholasticism wherever he could. He tried very hard to win over his old masters in Erfurt, Usingen and Trutfeld, but he failed in this attempt to give the new theology a broader base. And then, in September 1517, he was ready himself and published the disputation against scholastic theology. He composed his thesis with certain chapters of the Collectorium, the commentary on the sentences by Gabriel Biel, is the main target. In addition to Biel, also Scotus, Ockham, and Pierre Vallier are mentioned by name. Luther's marginal note to the same chapters in Biel, written in a copy of the Collectorium, offer us valuable insight into his preparation of these theses. By this time, virtually the entire university was on Luther's side. His efforts to spread his views beyond his own town, however, were limited in success when the new contest concerning indulgences, penance, and confession brought the intellectual world of Germany into turmoil. His Luther's actions and writings in the time of the 95 theses demonstrate the anti-scholastic campaign remained his aim. In accordance with his calling as a doctor of Holy Scripture, Luther saw it to be his duty to battle against any false interpretation of the Bible. Consequently, when he concluded that scholastic theology was distorting the meaning of Scripture, his aim became that of completely destroying scholasticism. He struggled to obtain this goal not only by disputations, lectures, and writings, but also by determined efforts to persuade the elector of Saxony of the necessity of the complete reform of the university curriculum. We can conclude, therefore, that the purpose of Luther's first public appearance was not the reform of the church, but the reform of theology and university. It may be added, however, that he saw such a reform as one of the indispensable conditions for the reform of the church, a goal for which so many people then longed. Certainly, scholasticism had been criticized before Luther began his campaign against it. Humanist biblical scholarship quite probably served to confirm Luther in his antagonism. But however much Erasmus of Rotterdam and other humanists had criticized and ridiculed scholasticism, Luther's wholehearted hostility was of a totally different kind. His animosity was grounded in an intellectual achievement which was entirely his own. As long as Luther maintained his stand, he was driven forward from step to step. There was no chance to compromise, as the contest over indulgences would very soon demonstrate. What we, according to my conviction, must realize is the extreme significance of Luther's anti-scholasticism attitude along every stage of his progress to the diet of worms. This recognition is not only essential for the interpretation of Luther's writings in these years, but it also offers an explanation for his widespread success among the humanists. The attack on the 95 ceases in the spring of 1580 with persons like Johann Tetzel, Johann Eck, and Sylvester Prierias as participants, placed Luther in a new situation. No longer could he choose the topics of debate in the way he had previously done in his self-imposed campaign. In order to defend himself against the accusations of heresy and error, he was forced to make clear his principles of theological proof. He did so already in a letter of February 1518 to his bishop. He proclaimed here that it is shameful for a theologian to speak without a text. This text, he explained, should not be Aristotle's, which they, that means the scholastic theologians, use more than enough, but our text, and that is the text of Scripture, the Church Fathers, and canon law. In Luther's answer to Prierias and in his explanations of the 95 theses, he maintained exactly the same criteria. At least until the meeting with Cardinal Caetan in October 1518, Luther had no reason whatsoever to think of the struggle as anything other than a continuation of his own anti-scholastic campaign. This perception is confirmed by the fact that Luther used the opportunity of writing the thesis for the Heidelberg disputation before the general chapter of his order in April 1518, he used this opportunity to proceed with his plea for a biblical theology in contrast to scholasticism. The Heidelberg disputation, with its frontal attack in the name of Paul and Augustine on scholastic speculation and moral theology, made a great impression on the audience. Among those who became very attentive to the friar from Wittenberg were the later reformers Martin Bucer and Johann Brentz. Certainly, some maintained, as Bucer wrote to his friend Beatus Renanus, that Luther said openly what Erasmus merely suggested. To Bucer, this was indeed the most important difference between Luther and Erasmus. How was it possible to listen to Luther and find him in harmony with the great humanism? It was only possible if the listener found the general theme of Luther's thesis to be the recommendation of the Bible at the cost of the scholastic doctrines. To have heard this statement declared openly in the blunt manner of Martin Luther must have been so amazing that Bucer barely considered the doctrinal elements in the thesis. Since Bucer must be regarded as an attentive and intelligent listener, this observation tells us something important, namely that precisely the anti-scholasticism in Luther's ideas was perceived at the time as the most remarkable part of what he had to say. If this conclusion is true, it becomes very understandable that Luther's fight with Tetzel and Prierias did nothing whatsoever to decrease sympathy conclusive. Indeed, quite the opposite. For what happened in the combat? Luther rejected any reference to the scholastic doctors as mere words, nuda verba. And he demanded proof, that means references to the scriptures, to the church fathers, or to the canon law. His ability as a polemicist soon gave him a name in humanist circles. At this stage, we can say that the confrontation was perceived above all as being one of method. Apart from his anti-scholastic polemic, very little was known, at least in Latin, about Luther, who had to that time not published any major work. The frame of reference was very much influenced by the conflict of Johann Reuslin and Erasmus with scholastic theologians from Cologne and Louvain, respectively. There was no reason why Luther's fellow scholars should not see his fight with the Thomists, Tetzel and Prierius, just as a continuation of these earlier clashes. This impression was confirmed when the explanation of the 95 theses, written in February, were finally published in August 1580. The explanations, Luther's first major book, concentrated on the question of theological argumentation, and therefore on true and false interpretation of theological texts, above all scripture. He insisted on the necessity to give account for faith, rationem reddere. But in order to do that, opinions were of no use, and opinions were what Luther called all scholastic arguments not based on sound theological text. It would, however, be completely false to understand this principle merely as a question of what you could call formal authority. When Luther accused the theologians of speaking without a text, seeing a text too, he did not necessarily mean that they were not quoting scripture. They were, indeed, very much. No, Luther implied that they used scripture against its meaning. In this sense, the entire combat remained a question of the true interpretation of scripture. By these ideas, Luther became convinced not of his own correctness, but of the true way to interpret the authoritative text. In the explanations, he could meet the objections of his opponents, the objections to his arguments, by labeling these objections unfounded opinions without a text. At the same time, he declared his readiness to obey the ecclesiastical authorities. He could do so because it was beyond his power to imagine a conflict between the unambiguous clarity of scripture and the official voice of the church. At the moment when he discovered this frightening possibility, that means at the meeting with Cajetan, he had already, in his fight with scholasticism, elaborated his ideas about the true interpretation of scripture to such an extent that no word of power could make him retreat. He regarded Cajetan simply as a scholastic theologian whose insistence on papal authority without reason or proof was powerless. As a matter of fact, he wrote back to Wittenberg that if Cajetan really, as it was said, was the foremost of all Dominican theologians, it had to look very badly in the, down in the rows. Due to the campaign against scholasticism, Luther had reached a point where he could no longer be persuaded to forsake his principles. The fact that he quite consciously saw his action is a duty of a doctor of Holy Scripture, and in that sense is a scholarly matter that became clear when Luther, in a letter of January 1519, wrote to the Elector of Saxony, "In our times, when the Scripture and the fathers have been brought forward, and when it is asked in the whole world, not what is said, but why this or that is said, I fear, would it not only be unbelievable, but also a division taught and an ignominious shame for the Roman Church if I would accept a mere word and recant?" The mere word was a word of the Pope. With these remarkable words, Luther held to the principles he had elaborated during the first round of the contest. These principles were won through the confrontation with scholastic argumentation, and thus constitute a sequel to the original anti-scholastic campaign. We need not dwell on the preparations for the Leipzig disputation, or the disputation itself. What happened there was really of great significance for the following time, but it contains little new material for our topic. In the meantime, the fearful possibilities of the now clearly ecclesiastical conflict had become obvious. But many humanists and other learned men seem to have thought along the same lines as Luther himself in his letter of January 1519. The new biblical learning was compared with the traditional way of argumentation represented in Leipzig by the very able Eck, but at the expense of him, of the latter of Eck. As far as any of Luther's followers were concerned, his way of doing theology, that means of interpreting Scripture, was really more important than his specific doctrines. If this perception is true, it would help to explain the doctrinal variety which Reformed theology would display in just a brief time. At least in 1519, when many of those who came to play an important part in the Reformation were won over to Luther's side, he was still known, above all, as the uncompromising antagonist of scholasticism, and as such, he was appreciated. For Luther himself, however, it was more important that the consequences of his campaign, with an inner logic of surprising coherence, had led him to the point where he was obliged to break with the ecclesiastical authorities in order to remain faithful to his own ideas of a true theology. From this point on, the way to Worms was a direct one. We can conclude that the ideas resulting from Luther's fight for new theology, in contrast to scholasticism, remained his theological basis also after the conflict caused by the 95 Theses. He certainly made new discoveries on the way, supported in doing so by his opponents, as he declares himself. But none of these discoveries forced him to change his fundamental views. The Leipzig disputation awakened and alerted some of the universities, first of all, Cologne and Louvain. and they were ready to act in a condemnation of Luther. When Luther became acquainted with their action against him, he was not at all impressed, but his obligation to his own university compelled an answer. A formal condemnation by a university was still considered a very serious matter. The two faculties had acted completely in accordance with the medieval way of handling dubious masters. After a short but crushing characterization of Luther's teaching, they just listed a number of sentences as heretical or dangerous. This method had once been effective and uncontested, but the condemnation of Luther was published at a time when academic circles in Germany were no longer ready to accept this kind of procedure. All adherents of serious scholarship looked upon this type of scholasticism as an outmoded and useless method. Luther's answer to the two universities' condemnation, and the same applies for his later answer to the Sorbonne in Paris, correspond with the view he had taken in earlier polemical writings. He regarded the accusations as void of meaning and therefore laughable because no reasons or proof were given for them. The condemnation consisted of mere words, and no human institutions, neither universities nor ecclesiastical authorities, are to be believed unless they render account for their statements. The radicality of this standpoint goes far beyond that of any other critic of scholasticism at the beginning of the 16th century. In the decisive year 1520, when Luther took the final steps toward open war with Rome, he could hardly hope any longer that a reform of Wittenberg University could provide a pattern which other universities would follow. In most cases, the universities remained scholastic until they eventually were reformed together with the churches in their respective countries or territories. It was the freedom of the university professor and the intellectual ability acquired and strengthened within the walls of the university which gave Luther the instruments to initiate the revolt leading to the Reformation. But ironically, his colleagues at other universities were the last to follow him. In the years 1520 to 22, when Luther, in a sense, completed his battle against Rome and the scholastic tradition, he still had urgent need of his own scholastic learning. He utilized this knowledge not only in some of his conflicts with private persons, but also in his critique of ecclesiastical institutions. If we take his attack upon the doctrine of the sacraments in the De Captivitate Babylonica, we see that Luther not only criticized scholastic opinions, but he also used the differences between the medieval schools to his own advantage. Some Luther scholars may have been led astray when Luther professed that he felt sympathy for the doctrine of consubstantiation. It would be completely wrong to interpret Luther's own doctrine of the Eucharist according to the Aristotelian concept or category of substance. Well, although Luther soon became involved in conflicts with people from the evangelical camp, scholasticism remained, in his eyes, the most serious enemy. In his academic lectures, where polemics were not the main concern, although often a necessary part of the interpretation of the text, constantly attacked scholastic doctrines. Later he told Erasmus and also Ulrich Zwingli that they were poor opponents compared with the scholastic theologians. It would therefore be wrong to understand Luther's antagonism towards scholasticism as lack of respect. On the contrary, he considered scholastic theology to be the worst obstacle to the gospel he knew of, and therefore he took it very seriously. His judgment of scholasticism also reflects the experiences of his youth. Scholasticism was a theology which had made him miserable as a friar, because it had left him to rely on his own moral abilities. But he also remained convinced about the high level of scholastic thinking. That quality was precisely what made it so dangerous, and what led him to continue the battle against it for the rest of his life. In any fight, the partners are always to some extent dependent on each other. In an intellectual fight, each person has to adjust himself to his opponent. Luther did so by using one school against the other. But he also returned to scholastic distinctions when they might be of help to his argument. Quite apart from the discussion about Luther's possible return to scholasticism, as he has been accused of in the contest with Erasmus, there's no doubt of his use of important scholastic terms and arguments. His discussion of the term necessity, for instance, is unthinkable without its scholastic basis. The same applies to his use of his distinction between different modes of presence in the Eucharist conflict with Zwingli. Luther obviously felt free to return to scholastic usage whenever it could improve his arguments. This practice is quite evident in the disputations of his later years. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have come to the conclusion now, which, as far as I see it, must be that scholasticism remained a focus for Luther all his life. He continued to consider scholastic theology the most dangerous of all obstacles to the right understanding of the gospel. At the same time, he felt free to use its intellectual achievements to sharpen his wit, to defeat less competent opponents, to argue in disputations, but above all, to warn against the clever ways by which men try to destroy the gospel. Thank you.
Agreed to answer questions you might have about the lecture, or some things that sparked his lecture might have sparked in your own mind. We have some time before I have to put it off to the airport. So please, if you have something you'd like to ask about, one need not be shy. Please, Patrick.
Realizing that there may be a slow coming of get to Denmark and Copenhagen, could you share with us how I got too familiar with how the Reformation affected Denmark as a country? It obviously is an evangelical country. How did that come about?
Well, yeah. That's a long story. I would love to tell you about it. And if I had could have been here until tomorrow, I would gladly have improvised something later today. But Carmelite monk named Paul Davis, or Paul Davis, yes, or his kind of prophetic language. And he seems to have learned his students of art. And some of the most important Davis reformers had never been in Germany on the internet. And poor Paul was faithful to the Roman Church, but the students didn't. They left him. So there was a movement, especially across the town, in the 20s, and in 36, the already elected king, Christian III, succeeded after 2 years of siege to conquer Copenhagen, and I know the most important town who had refused to receive him, and had cut out in more than 2 years or something. And then he started by throwing the bishops in prison and declaring that their power had ended. And that was the beginning of it. And then Guggenheim was called in to help, he was a specialist in arranging a reformation. So he came and helped the Danish reformers. No, what I meant with this remark, maybe I should have taken out my point when we had any time to say something more about it. What I mean is that it's true in 1520, Luther seems to have a little sympathy for the consubstantiation theory. But it's only in order to smash the transubstantiation. It's not because he's visually interested in that theory. And later in the Liberty Project, I think it's quite clear that the whole substance thinking is an opposite of Jesus' understanding of the Liberty. But that's a dark story that this doesn't go to China. They are now.
You spoke yesterday at the faculty forum, and the subject of others around Luther came up. If Luther is not responsible for getting scholasticism back into Lutheranism, who is?
Well,
who would you like to blame this one?
If I don't know if it might not be so easy to blame him, because I think those scholars are right to say that humanism, although it criticized the whole system of the medieval university, humanism. acceptable alternative. And I think that the, so to speak, the return of Anaphos is a sign of this embarrassment, not having anything to build on. And we all know that the organizer of the evangelical universities was not Luther, but Melanchthon. And he was a man who had to fall back, so to speak, on Aristotle, because he didn't know what else to do. That was the only way he could see to make some kind of coherent system of the different fields of philosophy and of teaching in the university. And I think Bob tried to tempt me to give Melanchthon all the blame for this. I think that would be too much. His shoulders are not getting enough for that. But he certainly is very operative in that aspect, but I have to see what he could do well, I must say. But he was a man who organized that thing. And he's also right that I very much agree with my Catholic friend Peter Knight when it comes to comparing Luther and Melanchthon. Just as man, I like Luther just as much as I don't like Melanchthon. I wouldn't say no opinion. I just find it very boring. I wouldn't say I have no opinion. I have to differentiate if I have given that impression. I really think it's extremely important. Yeah, excuse me. I see. If you think of a book like The Apology of the Augsburg Confession, I don't know. I can hardly stand thinking it. It's so dry, and he's repeating himself all over and over again. And there's not the fresh, the refreshing opening of thoughts that you always find in Luther. It's the question of justification becomes the question of the right formula. And he never does in this. He can talk about these things his whole life, and somehow he's always new. I also find it very, I must say, I felt much sympathy with Luther when I discovered that he tried in 1530 to write a book on justification and goodness. He couldn't just sit there and write a book about justification. It was not the way to do it. He could preach the gospel, and then it involved, he could interpret in Paul, and then it involved in the text. But write a book in paragraphs about justification, he couldn't do that. Melanchthon would be able to do that 100 times, and it wouldn't be more exciting for that, I think. Well, I see that I see very well that I really should have time to say more. But I do think that in the Langston already, the impetus of Luther's preaching and thinking is being narrowed into a formula, into dry teaching. And I also think that his ideas are dangerous in some ways, because with him there's already a tendency to, I don't know if everybody here would agree with me, but I think there's a tendency which I find dangerous to identify faith with certain theological formulas.
something alive, it's something personal, whereas formula, they are written down, and if you remain your formulas, they have the same wording all the time, but life is changing all the time. So it's not so easy just to repeat formulas. They don't have the same meaning in the next generation, even if it's the same word. And therefore, every identification of faith with doctrine is, I think, wrong. I have talked myself about that up in Fort Wayne 2 years ago. Yes, it did. I agree that the Augsburg Confession as a whole does give a good account of the evangelical preaching at the Reformation time. I totally agree about that. If you want me to do that, I'll gladly say that I think Melanchthon has done a good job there. Certainly. But I think that even the authors of the Formula of Concord had a sense of the historical place of the Augsburg Confession when they say it's a confession of our time. And if you think about that, there seems to be a real sense of the historicity of our existence in that. They mean, of course, there's no difference in teaching between the creed from the ancient church and the Augsburg Confession. But now they are standing in a particular situation where particular things have to be said. And therefore the Augsburg Confession is a confession for them of our time. And what has to be said cannot be resolved once and for all. If you think about also the creeds of the ancient church, not just something they said together and put down on paper because they felt like having a creed. It always came a need, which was the need of the time. And in that way, I think that the Oxford Confession was really the whole thing was really what had to be said in certain circumstances. I think there are more points when you can be a little doubt about him. I think he never solved the problem for him. For Luther, it was no problem. But Melanchthon never solved what was the problem for him, namely the relation between faith and his work. He never came to a real satisfying solution as far as I can see. And of course, there is also the Augsburg Confession. If you look close to the text, there are expressions which are not precisely the same what Luther thinks about. For Luther, there is no problem in this relation. No problem at all. Because faith is a well of which the good works spring. He doesn't have to find some kind of rational explanation. But then I found that with me. And why does he have that? That's a long story which we can't find here. Another thing is that I think, although I agree that the Augsburg Confession is a faithful account of the radiated preaching, I must say I like better Luther's dynamic way of writing confession, where the, so to say, the structure in Luther's confession is the Trinity. And that means the structure of his confession are the wonderful words of God, from the creation to the sanctification. In the answer of the Augsburg Confession, man becomes somehow the center of the whole thing. In a way, he isn't in Luther's confession. Yes, they are concerned with God. And they are concerned with man. But on the same day. And there's a difference, I think, is important. Not enough to make Luther and Lansdowne pass away, but I think in the long run, if Lansdowne dies, it will become dominating and not Luther. But, well.
Can you do it quickly, Harry? Well, of course, I don't think you must. Then when you say it goes following the life, and that the scholasticism of some form and sort of the handmaid of all the
that doesn't
sound
very quick.
Well, once more. Would you say then that scholastic in some form is sort of becomes a handmaiden of the dogmatician? They have to, like Melanchthon, they have to speak in that way to be the dogmatician.
Oh, I wouldn't like to think that. I think it must be possible to do it in another way. On the Luther Research Congress in 1771, Wagen Feindert, a countryman and I, gave a lecture on Luther as a theologian. And I remember he started by saying that in Luther you find no Loki communis, you find no institutio, you find no theological dogmatic, and so on. He went on like that. He gave the same lecture in the Philosophy Association in Copenhagen. And then I asked him, well, Sander, you mentioned all these, but there's also a book called The Experience of Henderson, that's kind of old dogmatic. And I said to him, well, wouldn't you say Luther would not even have written that one? And he said, you're right. He was here then retired and become a pastor again because he was an article of university policy. He said, no, you're right. If I was now a professor, I would not be doing that book. I would have used my teaching time by reading important scientific texts with my students and try to think together with them to the starting point. And I would not have written a dogmatic. So you see from this, this illustration, I do hope that I found this to be a dogmatician without
I'm tempted to let you miss your plane, but we can't do that. Once again, thank you very much this morning for your presentation.